Thanks for tuning in. This is Matt Santos of the Mile High Show. You're listening to episode number 45. I had a lot of fun recording today's episode with John Rust. He is the sports director and the local broadcasting sports authority here in the Prescott area. He is the sports director for KYCA, 1490 AM. They're located online at kyca.info as well. Aside from being the local sports guru, he's also an author. He's penned a couple of books detailing the history of Arizona baseball and also the Philadelphia Phillies, which is his diehard favorite team. Growing up in the Philly area, actually in New Jersey, near the Philly border, so he grew up a lifelong Phillies fan and has detailed the history of the team, compiling an all-Phillies team for one of his books, as well as an Arizona all-time baseball team. Those books, Arizona all-time baseball team, and where is it? Where's his Philly title? The Best Phillies Team Ever are both available on Amazon. We'll have links to those on our website, as well as his latest book, a little departure from his sports wheelhouse, Sea Raptor, a deep-sea thriller featuring hero Jack Raston, also available at Amazon. We sit down and talk with John about sports, about broadcasting, about his latest book, Sea Raptor, and had a good time doing it. So I hope you enjoy it. Today's episode was recorded at Gabby's Grill in Prescott Valley at the Entertainment District. Find out all the info about Gabby's at gabbysgrill.com. Make sure you follow John, Gabby's, and the Mile High Show on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Links to all of that are available at milehighshow.com. Enjoy the show. Get rid of that, and I printed out some of what you some of what you sent me.
Okay,
and then went on that went on your Marvel page, your blog there.
That's DC
some
one,
interesting stuff, man.
Cool, thank you.
DC. I'm sorry, yeah. I'm not a comic book. Yeah. that's a Matt Hinshaw.
Oh, gotcha.
Hinshaw deal. Hey, first while we start here, give me the rundown of where folks can see what you. What you put out, let's plug the station.
Okay.
Everything. Go for it.
All right. Basically, you can go to my Facebook author page, which is facebook.com/John J. Rust Author. You can also go to amazon.com and just type in John J. Rust, and my books will come up. I'm also on Goodreads, so you can just go to the search engine on Goodreads and type in John J. Rust there, and that'll take you to all my writing stuff.
Good deal, and I'll have links to that on the show notes, and on I'll do it on Facebook and through my web as well. How long have you been in the area? You're definitely not a an Arizona native.
19 years. I moved here in 1996 when I started with KYCA Radio, and been here ever since and still working for KYCA as their sports director.
For folks that aren't familiar with KYCA, what's the format over there?
It's News Talk and Sports. It's 1490 AM on the dial. I do all the sports reports and host Saturday morning Tri-City Sports Roundup show, and also do the Prescott High School football games on Friday night.
Which was last night, the big crosstown rivalries.
Prescott and Bradshaw, yeah.
Prescott Bradshaw. We were just talking about that before I plugged in here. It's unique with KYCA because you are the only one locally that's dedicated just to sports. You are kind of the sports authority in this area.
Lou made me the sports director there in 2003, late 2003. He felt that the area had grown to the point where the station could have a reporter dedicated practically full time to covering sports here. And, you know, over the last several years, that has been the case. From pretty much August through May, I am wrapped up in all kinds of sports. You know, we got fall sports from August to November, and then winter sports from November to February, and then spring sports from February to May. So it's kind of like the summertime is really sort of my break time.
Now, you started that in 2003, you said? Mm-hmm. Before that, what were you doing? Just general news and everything else?
Just general news and also play-by-play for the Prescott football and basketball teams.
But you had to do things other than sports.
Yeah. And actually, I still do, but still, primarily, yeah. I'm the sports guy.
What do you prefer doing? What's if you could pick one thing that you could just do sports wise, what would it be?
Just sports wise, I'd probably have to go with baseball.
Baseball.
I love covering almost all the sports, but baseball's my number one love.
Would you like to do that, like, as a full-time, or do you like the ability to do a little bit of everything different seasons?
I kind of like the ability to do everything, for all different seasons. I think it might get kind of old after a while just concentrating on one.
Yeah.
Kind of like with writing, you know. I mean, I kind of sometimes dub myself as a science fiction author, but I like dabbling in other genres, too.
Yeah, the nonfiction, which you had the All Philly. What was the title of that? I got that one here somewhere.
The Best Phillies Team Ever.
Ever. Now, is that hometown for you?
Pretty much. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, right across the river from Pennsylvania. And where I was in New Jersey, I was in Mercer County, and that's like central Jersey. So we're sort of on the dividing line. Pretty much everything south of Mercer County goes for the Philadelphia teams. Everything north goes for the New York teams. So I'm right on the borderline, and my whole family's been Philadelphia fans forever.
Now, what brought you to Arizona? Why'd you choose Arizona?
The job.
Yeah.
KYCA wanted to hire me, and I was working at another radio station at the time, New Jersey 101.5, and I was looking to move on and hopefully get something more sports related. And the opportunity came up for me to come to KYCA here in Prescott and do play by play for high school football.
What were your roles in Jersey radio?
I pretty much did, because that was my starting ground.
Yeah.
So I pretty much did everything. I was a call screener. I was a production assistant. I was a street reporter. I anchored morning news on our AM station. So again, I kind of did a little bit of everything, and also kind of got my feet wet with sports reporting, because we had a double-A team there, the Trenton Thunder, and I covered them on a regular basis.
Nice. So was the format there mainly news, talk news?
News talk. Actually, yeah. We were the largest news radio organization in the state.
Nice. What, were you always a sports nut growing up?
Oh, yeah. I did Little League until I was about 11, and that's when I found out I had absolutely no athletic ability whatsoever. But I still loved it, and I decided from an early age that, if I can't play sports, then I want to broadcast it. And I mean, in that area, I grew up listening to Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn doing the Phillies games, and just, Harry had just one of the most distinct, awesome voices and best deliveries around. Middle school, high school, NBC was doing Game of the Week with Vince Scully and Joe Garagiola, and Vince Scully just became my idol for broadcasting.
Now, for the folks around here that know you, you are known for your passion at games. You get a little wound up a little time.
Hey, why not? It's sports. It's supposed to be fun, and there are some exciting moments. So I got to get wound up.
So talk a little bit about you mentioned about the Mets going in, not your favorite team.
No, not at all.
How was your year watching baseball this year?
It was so hard. Being a Phillies fan, just seeing them. We didn't get to 100 wins, but we still had like the worst record in baseball. Just to see the guys who got us the 2008 World Championship and all those National League East crowns, just see their skills just completely deteriorate. It was really hard to watch, and then just waiting for Ruben Amaro Jr. to be fired, because he was to me he was one of the architects of the demise. You can't blame this all on one person.
If you weren't wearing that Diamondbacks hat right now, I think I'd be able to see that vein popping on your forehead.
and also, I'm a Red Sox fan too, and it was hard to see them. Signed the two big free agents, Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez, and they both tanked. We didn't have a frontline starter for whatever reason. They thought we could get by with just having three or four guys who should be three and four in the rotation, carry us through, and it didn't work. And then to see the Yankees get in the playoffs, and then the Mets get in the playoffs, and even the Diamondbacks. I'm Arizona. I do cheer for the Diamondbacks, and half the time it seemed like the Diamondbacks couldn't make up their mind if they wanted to be a good team or a bad team. And then combine that with a horrible season for all my hockey teams, and the Eagles getting off to a bad start. There were some times where I just went, maybe I'll just start going to see more movies instead of watching sports, because it is just getting like really, really hard to watch. But I think in the case of the Phillies, I see some promise with some of their young guys, like Michael Franco and Aaron Nolan, some of those guys. Kenny Giles, who pitched right here at Yavapai College, he has emerged as a great closer. He's probably one of the best players on the team. So you are seeing some hope now. We're going to get a new general manager, and hopefully he will make, the right kind of deals to get some players in there that can actually help us, because some of the trades the Phillies have made the last few years have just left me scratching my head. And, we give away all these great players and we get nothing in return. Hunter Pence is a perfect example, because I think we got to Nate Scherholz and some other guy, and I don't even know what they're doing now. And meanwhile, Hunter Pence has three World Championship rings for the Giants.
Calm down, John. Yeah. Hey, so your love of all things Phillies, that was the germination, I'm sure, for your all-time Phillies book.
It was.
Yeah. How did you start? What kind of research did you do for that, and was it related just to the book, or did you just draw on your lifelong fandom?
It was both. Because, again, the Phillies have actually been around since the late 19th century. Yeah. They started playing in 1885. And, just sitting around, you just thinking of, think of all the great players that have passed through Philadelphia. And, if you had to, I think every fan does that with their team. If we had to pick like an all-time roster, who would be on it? And that started the germ of my idea. Now, a lot of it I knew just from growing up and rooting for the Phillies. Like, right off the bat, I knew Mike Schmidt was going to be, my third baseman. I mean, to me, I'm not only is he the greatest third baseman in Phillies history, to me, and I know people who love Brooks Robinson will argue with me on this and will probably have some valid points, but to me, I think Schmidt is the best third baseman in baseball history, period. Yeah. But I also wanted to do some other research, because there were some Phillies that, date back to, early on the 19th century, the early 20th century. So I had to do some research on them, and also just kind of write down a list, because, it's not just, the, like a nine man lineup. You're looking at the starting eight. You're looking at a pitching rotation, the bullpen, the bench, and who would I get as my manager?
Did the research feed the book, or did the book come out of just your natural curiosity to find out about the team you love?
I think it was more the research fed the book. Some of the positions were easy to come up with. Others were a little harder. And even as a Phillies fan, I discovered some things about the team history that I had not known.
That was my next question. What were some of the surprises that came as somebody with such a deep wealth of knowledge about not just the team, but the sport in general? What kind of surprises came up in your research?
Not to give away everything in the book, but to me, the biggest surprise was a player that I put on the best Phillies team ever bullpen by the name of Charlie Ferguson. And I had never even heard of this guy my entire life as a Phillies fan. And I did some research on Charlie Ferguson. And it's really just a sad, tragic story with him. He only spent 4 years with the Phillies, but in that time he won 99 games. And there was one season where Ferguson, the pitcher, actually led the team in RBIs.
What years are we talking?
Oh, these are the 1880s, 1890s.
Okay, this is old school.
Yes, I mean, so this is when you didn't have, you know, pitch counts.
Yeah.
You didn't have, specialists. I mean, the bullpen was basically baseball Siberia for
you. Yeah, the guys who were on their way down.
Yeah, I mean, so we're talking about a guy who has records of, like, you know, 30 wins and 19 losses or something like that. When the days he wasn't pitching, he was playing second base. He was playing outfield. And what happened was, after Ferguson's fourth season with the club, he came down with, I believe it was tuberculosis. He got a lung disease, and he died shortly before the next season started. And he was only 25, 26.
Oh, wow.
So this was a guy. I mean, you want to talk about your life and your career being cut short? Because when I look at what he did those 4 years, you got to think, if he lived and pitched into his 40s or whatever, you know, Charlie Ferguson could probably be in the Hall of Fame, and people might be talking about him in the same vein they do guys like Nolan Ryan and Walter Johnson and even Cy Young.
Yeah. What are some – you talked about some of them, but some of the changes to the game over the years, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on things like records with expanded seasons and you know, hitting records and home run records. There's a lot of talk about how with expansion teams and things, pitching gets diluted and the training and, of course, steroids, all that. How has the game in your mind changed over the generations?
Ugh. Wow, how much time do we have here?
As long as you want.
But
they serve dinner here too, so we're good.
Well, I think you mentioned the steroids. I maybe look at it a little differently than some people do, where some people look at it as cheating. A lot of times I look at it as just being stupid, because you're going to give yourself those, you know, 5 or 6 years where you're really going to be knocking the ball around, but then when you get in your 40s and 50s, what's that going to do to your
body?
The
damage that it takes toll.
It's for every sport. There's always the argument that when you expand the number of teams, the talent pool is going to be diluted. But you know, even still, you're still getting really good people coming into baseball. I mean, you know, even with what we have, 30 teams now in Major League Baseball. So 30 times 24 is going to be what, 600, 700 baseball players out of how
millions,
many millions?
And, millions around.
And again, it's only the cream of the crop that we're taking. And you know, to me, you're hitting 40, 50 home runs a year today. It's still a big deal, as it was back in, you know, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, when you had guys like Mays and Aaron and Mantle doing that. And then, of course, with the pitching, like I said, one of the things doing research for not just my Phillies book, but my Arizona's all-time baseball team book, is just the way pitchers are handled. Because, you know, you look at guys like Steve Carlton or Robin Roberts, or, you know, in my book, of course, one of the probably the greatest pitcher to come out of the state of Arizona, which would be Jim Palmer. These are guys who would have, you know, 20 complete games in a season. They'd be pitching like 300 innings or something like that. And, you know, the way things are today with pitch counts and, you
know, are they coddled?
Oh, yeah. I think that is definitely a fair assessment you can make of today's pitchers. Not only are they coddled, but I think another problem is everyone is just so caught up in how many miles per hour can you throw? You know, how hard can you throw that ball? And I think that's what a lot of younger pitchers are doing instead of learning how to pitch, learning when to go to the fastball, when to go to off-speed stuff,
mix it
where
up.
To locate. Yeah, and then the other thing that I think is a problem is a lot of these players really don't get any time off during the year. It's they're in their high school or college teams. Then they'll go to a club team. Sometimes in college, you're going to go to like a summer or semi-pro league. And then there's all kinds of
the camps and workshops
and off field condition. And you know, there comes a point where you have to say, look, first of all, the human body, the arm was not meant to throw like you see major league pitchers do. I feel you have to give your body a rest. And I think that's why we're seeing, you know, guys like Matt Harvey, guys like, Fernandez from the Marlins, and Steven Strasburg getting like Tommy John surgeries before they even turn 25.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I mean, you know, guys like Palmer and Carlton, they could pitch, you know, 280, 300 innings a year for, you know, 10, 11, 12 years.
Yeah, they were working at car dealerships on this offseason.
Yeah.
how has, now, you've done the research both with your Arizona's all-time baseball, your Phillies all-time ball, all-time team book. You've studied stats and figures and stories and characters from multi-generations. How do they compare from, because this is how, and I'm definitely not an expert on anything, let alone baseball. I'm not even an expert on what goes on in my own house. but in my head, as a fan looking in, when you've got guys who are trained and have a team of physicians, nutritionists, conditioning coaches that work with them all year long, day in and day out, and they've been doing that, a lot of these guys, since they were in the, you know, in the pony leagues and little league and stuff when they're, you know, all the way up through their pros. Compare that, and as top-notch athletes as they are, compare that to the guys in the 30s and 40s who, you know, drank a six-pack between innings, down in hot dogs, smoking cigars, and then go, oh, it's my turn up at bat.
Yeah.
You know, the Babe Ruth, and they were still crushed. How would, say, Lou Gehrig, he got sick, doesn't count. How would a DiMaggio do? What if somebody with DiMaggio's talent was playing in 2015?
That is actually a good question. And again, with all the kind of training that went on, I think DiMaggio would probably have put up even better stats than he did back then. And obviously, Joe DiMaggio was a phenomenal athlete and a phenomenal fielder. But yeah, if you get him in on the kind of training regimens that they have now, the kind of athletic trainers that they have, because, you know, I mean, toward the end of his career, I remember reading the book Summer of 49 by the late historian David Halberstam. Yeah, and a great book, by the way. I highly recommend it. But he detailed how the first half of that 1949 season, Joe DiMaggio could barely get out of bed.
Yeah.
And
heels, right? When his
heels, I think it was pretty much every, because this was coming down toward the end of his career, obviously. But imagine if he had the benefit of some of the medical technology and the medical knowledge and the training that we
and
that
just
we have
the
today.
Common sense that we have now that
I mean, well, it's always been said. I think Mickey Mantle is a perfect example of that, because basically a lot of people said, you know, if it wasn't for all the drinking and carousing that Mantle did, you know, the stats he put up could have been phenomenal. Yeah. He put up great stats, you know, in spite of all the things that he did to his body.
What was that movie that they came, I think it was an HBO movie. 61?
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. That was a good story. They told it well. I think it was Billy Crystal, wasn't it, that did that? Also, he ranks right up there in fanaticism on baseball that you do. I think you got Billy Crystal beat a little bit there. Growing up, were you and your family, were you guys regulars at the ballpark?
We went to quite a few Phillies games, and of course that was back at Old Veterans Stadium, the one of the cookie cutter horrible artificial turf stadiums. Again, it's part of me that, you know, I'm not sad to see the stadium go the way of the dodo, because it was It wasn't really a great...
When was that basic, built? Do you remember when
it was built? It was built in 70... Well, it opened in 71.
Okay, so it wasn't one of the traditionals.
Oh, no. This was in the same vein of like Riverfront Stadium, Three River Stadium, old Busch Stadium before they remodeled it. But, you know, in spite of that, I still had some pretty good times down there at Vet Stadium watching the Phillies win or lose. And the unfortunate thing is I still haven't gotten back there to go to Citizens Bank Park, which, you know, everything I've seen from that is a really, really nice looking stadium.
In the last, I want to say, 15 years or so, as some of the older stadiums have been replaced and some of the... some of the ugly monoliths, the league, the owners, the developers and engineers have really gotten into building some real showcase state of Baltimore. My old stomping grounds in the Bay Area whatever it's called now, it was Pac Bell. The Giants home field, beautiful stadium. And they seem to be going back to that as opposed to the big, huge...
Yeah.
Candlesticks, Astrodomes, you know, the big uglies. So it's nice to see the stadiums coming back with some character. Do you remember your first game that you attended?
Believe it or not, my very first game was at Shea Stadium for the Mets. But actually, it was the Mets and the Phillies were playing there. And that was my very first experience. And of course, you know, being from where we were in Jersey and my family being Phillies fans, I'm like, I guess I'm going to be a Phillies fan. And right when I started watching baseball, that was when the Phillies really started picking it up. That was the late 70s. So I had a run of three straight National League East crowns, and that was when they had Schmidt, Luzinski, Boone, Carlton, McGraw, some of those guys, of course, who are mentioned in my Best Phillies Team Ever book. And then, of course, 1980 comes around. Phillies win the first World Series. And to this day, it sticks out in my mind watching the TV at 10 years of age and Tug McGraw throwing up his arms in the air when he strikes out Willie Wilson to win the series. And also the other thing I clearly remember is, you know, because it's Philadelphia and fans there do have a tendency to get a little out of hand. I remember...
I wanted to touch on that.
Oh,
go
yeah.
Ahead.
It was, as Tug McGraw's, you know, in his windup and everything, you see Philadelphia police officers with canines circling around home plate. Then you see an officer on horseback coming around. So it's like the Philadelphia police, they were ready. Because I think a couple of years before in the Yankees World Series, when they won, the fans just rushed the field and completely trashed it. And Philadelphia was like, yeah, we're not putting up with that. We're doing a show of force here to make sure that everyone stays in the stands.
Let's go on to your all Arizona team. Was this again? Did you set out to do this book, or did this come up with just in your fandom of baseball?
I think one of the things that happened was, you know, I wrote the Phillies book, and you know, obviously, you know, Philadelphia is like 2,300 miles from here, but I'm like, you know, I'm here in Arizona, so why don't I do a book about Arizona baseball, and again, do a 25-man roster. And yeah, I think this was a little trickier than the Phillies book, because with the Phillies book, I had, you know, 130 years worth of teams and rosters and players to choose from. Where in Arizona, I think at this point, we have a little less than 100 Arizona-born players who have actually made it to the big leagues.
Yeah.
And then you factor in maybe 20 to between 20 and 40 transplants who graduated from high school here in Arizona and went on to play in Major League Baseball. Probably the most two of the most familiar I would think would be Paul Konerko, who retired last year from the White Sox, and of course Jim Palmer, who was actually, I think he was born in New York, moved to Los Angeles, then came to Scottsdale. And that was really my criteria. If you're born in Arizona or you at least graduated high school in Arizona, and that's what I was going with. But and yeah, like I said, it was a little tricky.
Had some formative years here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's the best way to put it, formative years. And the other thing was that, you know, being in Arizona and being, being the sports director at KYCA for over a decade, I actually got to know some of the coaches who coach some of these guys. Like locally, Ted Blake, who's the athletic director for Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Well, he was the baseball coach at Greenway High School when Tim Salmon was there. And of course, Salmon went on to be one of the best players in Angels history. Kent Winslow, who coaches baseball over at Prescott High School, He was down at Corona del Sol when Ian Kinsler, the current Tiger second baseman, was down there. So I was able to interview them. I interviewed Jerry Dawson, the former Chaparral coach, now assistant coach at Yavapai College, because he coached Paul Konerko. I got some great comments from them. And the one thing I had to do also was come up with a manager for my team. And that was kind of tough because there was only one Arizona-related Major League Baseball manager, and that was Solly Hamus, who was a pretty darn good player for the Cardinals back in the 50s. But his managerial career in 3 years with the Cardinals, he barely got to 500.
Yeah.
And probably what he's most known for as manager of the Cardinals is, believe it or not, actually benching Stan Musial for a month. So it's like, I mean, granted, this was toward the end of Musial's career,
yeah.
But you know, it's not really something that people are going to look fondly on. So I'm like, okay, well. But I'm like, okay, well, you know what, Arizona, like, you know, U of A and ASU, well, they've had some really good teams, so let's look at their coaches. And that's where I came up with Jim Brock, the former ASU mm-hmm. coach. And you know, I wanted to get some comments about him, and I learned about his wife, Pat, and I contacted ASU's athletic department, and they got me in touch with Pat Brock, and I said, I'd like to do an interview with you on this book. I figured I was going to do it over the phone like I did with some of the other out of
yeah.
the Prescott area coaches, including Jerry Kindle, the former U of A coach. I interviewed him about Gil Heredia. And by the way, Jerry Kindle, just such a fantastic person, just super nice guy, super cool. And then I got an email back from Pat Brock, and she says, I'd love to be interviewed for your book. Why don't you come down to the ASU Oregon State game on such and such a date? I'll leave you a ticket and we'll talk there. And
I'm just nice.
Yeah, I'm like, she doesn't even know me from Adam. And she's like, okay, well, I go get my interview, and then I'm going to watch a college baseball game for free. And the cool thing was, it was Oregon State, and I knew one of the players on there from Prescott,
nice.
Michael Howard. And actually ran into his family. They're like, what are you doing down here? And I was like, oh, I'm getting an interview for my book. But and Pat Brock couldn't have been nicer. I got some great stuff from her, not just on her late husband, but also on Bob Horner, who is in my book, and you know, was probably one of the best college players ever. You know, when I did the research on Horner, and I still have a hard time fathoming how a college baseball player can get 100 RBIs in a season when you don't even play 100 games in a college season, even if you do go on
yeah.
to the College World Series.
Without giving too much away on the book, what was one of the big surprises that you had in here? You mentioned yeah. on the Phillies one, mm-hmm. the pitcher. Mm-hmm. The one you didn't know about. What mm-hmm. about here? Anything that caught you by surprise? Caught you on your heels?
I think it was just some of the players who came from Arizona that I didn't really know too much about. I think probably case in point would be Hank Lieber, who was. Came from the Tucson area, had a pretty good Major League Baseball career, played for the New York Giants. In fact, was in a couple other World Series and had swung for a lot of power. But unfortunately, he suffered two really serious beanings in his career. One of those beanings, by the way, was in spring training, and the guy who hit him, I don't know if people may be familiar with his name, but it's Bob Feller. So, I mean, the guy who was known for having one of the greatest fastballs yeah. of his era nailed Lieber right in the head. I think knocked him out for a Jeez. Day or two. So that really hurt his career. And it's kind of like Charlie Ferguson, if it wasn't, except you know, instead of him dying at a very young age, you'd think of Lieber as like, if it wasn't for all those injuries.
Yeah, where could he have gone?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, Feller even... mentioned Lieber before, saying, you know, if it wasn't for all that, the guy probably could have been in the Hall of Fame. You know, that's how good he was.
Yeah. Okay. A side knock, not well, you can include him, but not concentrating on Arizona mm-hmm. or Philly,
mm-hmm.
just baseball in general.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the best player nobody's ever heard of? The most unsung hero.
The best player no one has ever heard of. Ooh, boy.
Somebody who needs to have that light shined on him but doesn't get the...
The one that I would say, I mean, probably people have heard about him, but I think he is the one who has been really undeservedly snubbed by the Hall of Fame, Dave Concepcion. You look at this guy's stats. I mean, 19 years in the bigs. I think he was a nine-time All-Star, over 2,000 career hits, 5 Gold Gloves. He has 2 World Championships. And for whatever reason, this guy is not in the Hall of Fame. And to me, it's like if you're going to have Phil Rizzuto and Pee Wee Reese and Barry Larkin and guys like that in the Hall, you got to include Concepcion.
Why is he not getting the recognition? Didn't he not have a good relationship with the press? Or
I think one of the reasons is, I mean, Concepcion played for that big red machine team in the 70s. And I think in a lot of ways, I think he was overshadowed by some of the more powerful hitters, the Tony Perez's, the Johnny Benches, the George Fosters.
That era of the Reds had so many personalities on them.
Exactly. I mean, you had Pete Rose. You had Joe Morgan came on, won two straight MVPs. And you had Sparky Anderson as the manager. And also, that was the time when shortstops were looked upon as all glove and no hit.
Yeah.
But Concepcion could actually hit, and he had over 200-300 stolen bases in his career. So, yeah, he was not a shortstop in the modern mold of, say, a Jeter or a Garcia Parra or a Tejada,
but
where they're going to hit a lot of home runs.
Yeah.
And to me, he was probably the best shortstop of his era. And I say this being a fan of Larry Boa back in the time. And I think that's one of the reasons he didn't hit for a lot of power, and he got overshadowed by so many other people on that big red machine team that just so dominated the 1970s.
Take one of those names. What's your thoughts on Pete Rose?
Pete Rose. you know what? In spite of all his off-field problems, and he probably is not, you know, maybe the friendliest guy in the world from some of the stuff I've heard, I would still have this guy on my team any day of the week. His off-field problems aside, when you put him out on the field, you know that guy is going to give you 110% every single inning. And again, maybe his personality aside, you can live with that. It's not like it's someone like a Darryl Strawberry, who I don't care how talented you are, I don't want you on my team because you're nothing but a disruptive influence. Pete Rose, it's like, you know what, whatever you do off the field, hey man, you know.
It didn't affect him on.
No. Absolutely not.
If he could just take some of that enthusiasm and do something about the haircut. What's your take as a journalist? What's your take on separating the off-field activity from the on-field activity across the board, whether that be football and all the problems the NFL has had, legal and everything else, Lamar Odom's recent issues. As far as for things like Hall of Fame consideration, for one, do you think that off field, off court activity should affect what happens, whether or not you get into a hall?
I think to a certain extent. I mean, we've seen some baseball players who maybe were not the friendliest people in the world get into the Hall of Fame. But to me, you know, not being the nicest guy in the world shouldn't dissuade people from putting you in the Hall of Fame if you have the numbers. I know sometimes people said Steve Carlton wasn't Mr. Warm and Fuzzy and didn't like to talk to the press.
Yeah.
But that aside, it's like, guy's a 300-game winner, won like 4 Cy Young Awards, and he went out there and he did his job. So to me, that's fine. Pete Rose, I think, I'm on the fence with Pete Rose because it's like, you know, the guy was one of the greatest hitters, if not the greatest pure hitter in baseball. And, you know, again, when it comes to, you know, well, he bet on baseball and there were the whole things, well, did he bet against his team? But, you know, when you're betting on baseball while you're in baseball, it's like, you know, that really is something I think is pretty hard to have, you know, the powers of being baseball forgive you.
Because where do you draw the line when you find somebody actually shaving points or pulling up short on things?
The Shoeless Joe Jackson incident. Yeah. Even though there's a lot of controversy saying, well, look at Shoeless Joe's stats, and when you look at the stats, how could you say he intentionally threw the series and everything? But unfortunately, he was involved in that. But when you look at people like say a Ray Rice, as a most recent example. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, but you go around and you smack around your wife. I don't care how talented you are. Forget about being in the Hall of Fame. You should not even be in the league, period. Yeah. You do have
behind
to set
bars.
Some standards. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You do have to set some standards. And unfortunately, that's one of the things that has really been just grating on my nerves the last few years, where you have, Roger Goodell. I recently saw a story where one of the guys on the Pittsburgh Steelers got fined because in the little eye black thing he had the name of his father who died from cancer, and he put that on to honor him. And here's the NFL saying, we're fining you $11,000 because you won't remove that. And I'm like, are you kidding me? It's like you fine this guy $11,000 and then you drag your feet for months on the whole Ray Rice thing. It's like, honoring your father with eye black or
giving a black eye.
which is the more serious of the two. To me, I think Roger Goodell, honestly, with the way that he's handing out discipline, concentrating on these little things and just seems to be foot dragging on a lot of the big issues. To me, Roger Goodell has become a parody of himself.
Now, is it a case of athletes being put on such a high pedestal as far as, fame, endorsements, mm-hmm. money, contracts, and thinking they're above reproach? Or is it the fact that now in 2015, 21st century, there's a camera on every corner in every elevator, there's internet, there's Twitter, TMZ, everything else? Or is it a combo of all that?
I think what it is I think it really goes down to what kind of person they are before they get rich and famous.
But is it changing now, or have people always been like that? We just didn't know about it.
I think it's always been like that, and we just didn't know about it because we didn't have the kind of media outlets we do now. But to me, the vast majority of athletes from high school to pro that I've interacted with, they all come off as very decent people, very good people. I think it's like the majority of society. You got a lot of good people around. But like I said, the athletes, say like Ray Rice, like Daryl Strawberry and the like, I think those were people who just, were problem people, growing up and through high school and college. Then they get to the pros and they sign the big contract and then they get more of the spotlight on them. And whatever badness they had in them, it might get amplified by the money, by the fame and glory.
Living
the high life and everything, where to me, you get a person who grew up as, with the good family, good background, good, decent person. They're going to make a lot of money and, they are still a very grounded, very well-liked person. I think some good examples of that.
You that. Who stands out on that?
To me, there are a few. Miguel Cabrera. I mean, he's making a lot of money, but you never hear anything bad about the guy. I think Paul Goldschmidt is another one. Mike Trout is another one. They're very successful at what they do. They make a good amount of money, and like I said, you just don't hear anything bad about them. Like I said, it goes back to what kind of person are you going into professional sports? And I think if you're a good person, no matter how much money you make, you're still going to remain, for the most part, you're going to remain a good person. Obviously, there are going to be some exceptions because I think, hey, we're all human. And I think there are going to be some people who, get all the wads of money, and that might change them to an extent. But if you are really well-grounded and come from a really good background and taught to be nice to people, show people courtesy and respect, I think that's going to carry over no matter how rich and famous you get.
You take 50 athletes, you're going to find 5 that are idiots.
You take
50 journalists, you're going to find probably 30 that are idiots. It's the ones that I know.
It's the same with any group. It's the same with cops, teachers, businessmen, whatever.
Let's shift gears a little bit, John, because I do want to talk about Sea Raptor. Mm-hmm. You sent me over the bio on the main character. I pulled off from Amazon some of the synopsis of it. But give us in your words it's completely shifting gears from your what we as listeners on KYCA and folks that see you around at all the games. This is different than the John Russ we know. What's the plot summary of Sea Raptor?
Basically, what happens in Sea Raptor is in this story, Bigfoot has been discovered, and an organization was formed called the Foundation for Undocumented Biological Investigation.
How do you pronounce that?
The FUBI.
I just call
it the FUBI.
F-U-B-I.
Yeah. But,
I was trying to figure out. FUBI?
Sometimes they nickname it FUBI, but basically what they do is they go out and they look for what are called cryptids, which are animals that have not yet been proven to exist by mainstream science. So like that would be, say, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, Ogopogo up in Canada, the Chupacabra, the Chesapeake Bay Monster, Mothman, Jersey Devil, things like that. And Jack Raston is a former United States Army Ranger, and he grew up in Philadelphia. It's like I gotta kind of keep that East
Coast
connection.
Well, that's what I was gonna ask, because Jack is also a nickname for John. Mm-hmm. Problems on the Jersey Shore. is this your alter ego?
I don't know if you'd call it my alter ego, but again, you know, this is kind of the area I grew up in. I think all authors take some elements of themselves and put them into their characters, and I've done that with Jack. Jack is a big Philadelphia sports fan, and that's one of the things I wanted to do, because I think in a lot of these action novels, you only see the hero basically at his job.
Kicking butt.
Yeah, whether he's like with the CIA or Army Special Forces or something like that. And I wanted to show there was more of a dimension to Jack. So I make him a big Philadelphia sports fan. I make him a heavy metal fan.
We're going to touch on your heavy metal addiction.
Also, you know, his parents grew up. He grew up around parents that basically run the Philadelphia Zoo. So he's kind of a self-taught animal expert. And then you combine all that with the fact that he spent 6 years as an Army Ranger. He was a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. He has to leave the Army. And really at the beginning of the book, he really doesn't know what to do, because he had geared himself since high school to becoming an Army Ranger. Now that he doesn't have that anymore, it's like there's really nothing in the civilian world that has that kind of appeal to him, where, you know, he doesn't find it as challenging as he did being a ranger. And actually, a friend of mine actually went through ranger school, and I've talked to him quite a bit about that to get some ideas for Jack's
character. I was going to ask, what kind of research did you do in there?
Oh, I did. Obviously, I'm a huge military history buff anyway. But I researched the history of the Rangers. I watched some documentaries on their training. And there was one I saw on Discovery Channel where it showed one class going through Ranger school. And just the way they run those guys ragged, and how they're operating and trying to perform tasks with maybe 3 hours of sleep, if that, maybe eating one meal a day. So basically it's just about trying to break these guys down physically and mentally and see which ones are able to just power through it and come out on the other side. And I remember watching that documentary. At the end of it, I just said, boy, Jack Raston is an even bigger bad bleep than I originally thought he was. But I, you know, that's the kind of research I did. Also, you know, did some background on like animals that would be at the Philadelphia Zoo, maybe what it would be like growing up at the Philadelphia Zoo. So that's how I came to develop Jack Raston. And like I said, I talked to my friend, actually, John Markham, whose daughter probably a lot of people around here know, Maddie, former Prescott soccer standout, and also played in Embry-Riddle. But He gave me a lot of tips. And one of the things he was talking about was he's part of a group that kind of helps veterans adjust to life after the military, called Red, White, and Blue. And A lot of it is they're just around, you know, their buddies all the time. They know they can depend on them. You know, they'll give their lives for them. And then when they come back to the civilian world, they don't find that kind of bond, that kind of camaraderie. And some of those elements I put into Jack Rassen at the beginning of the novel, where he doesn't have, you know, that like core group of bonded warriors that he will fight and die for. He doesn't have the kind of challenges. He doesn't feel like there's any job out there where he feels he's doing something very important for the country, for the world, for innocent people. And then finally, his old CO from the Rangers gives him a call and says, hey, I'm like the field security director for the FUBI, and I think you'd be perfect for this job. So you're hired.
He finds a new home.
Yep. So now it's like, okay, well, now I can take the skills that I used as an Army Ranger and put them to good use, here. You know, just protecting research groups from poachers, or maybe protecting them, as in this book, from the big bad sea monster that's roaming up and down the Jersey Shore and eating people.
Now, this was the debut of Jack Rassen?
Yes, this is the first Jack Rassen novel.
You planning some others? Are you in the works?
I have. I've already written my first draft of the sequel, and I'm sending that through some critiquers right now, and so far so good. Obviously, there's some changes
tweak,
and some edits and some revisions that I got to do. That's the case with any novel. But you can expect to see Jack Rassen again.
You hope this to turn into a long-term series?
I hope so too. Obviously, I hope Severed Press, which is my publisher for this, likes it enough. And the book actually came out as a self-published last year. Then I got picked up by Severed Press,
nice.
Which is,
congrats.
Thank you. This is kind of funny because Severed Press is actually a small publishing company based, believe it or not, in Tasmania. And they have a line of sea monster and kaiju. For those who know, kaiju is basically the Japanese word for giant monster.
Gojira.
Well, that's just one of them, but again, for people who are fans of Godzilla movies, Gamera movies, kaiju is always thrown out. If you remember the movie Pacific Rim, that's what they called the monsters,
okay.
The kaiju. So they have those books available, and I didn't even seek them out. They just dumped an email me one day and said, "Hey, we saw your novel Sea Raptor, which actually did pretty well as a self published book. I had quite a few sales." And they said, we think your book would be great for our line.
Right in their family, huh?
Yeah, and I didn't say yes right away because you want to research. You want to research. And again, you know, there are some publishing outfits out there that are pretty unscrupulous.
It's your creation, your baby. Are you going to give it away and then find out there's 10 other Jack Rassen novels that you didn't have anything to do with?
Exactly. There's a lot of research you want to do before you commit to signing a contract with a publishing company. I checked out some of the other books they've had and seen how they did. Look to make sure there were no real like a ton of bad reviews online. And again, sometimes you have to take it with a grain of salt because in the internet age, anyone can say anything bad about anyone or any company. So
it's easy to do from the comfort of your living room at 3 in the morning or your mom's basement.
But I did all that research and because I almost got taken in by one company years ago for Sea Raptor, where they sent me this really rosy contract and, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And then they ended it by, oh, by the way, you need to pre-purchase 700 copies of your book and it'll cost $10,000. Yeah. And that set off the alarm. Yeah. It's like, first of all, unless you're a vanity press, like self-publishing press, you don't ask that kind of money from your authors. So I knew this was a scam.
And technology now, the way it is, whether it be through electronic downloads, Kindle, or even paperback printing, you can do single batch. You know, it's not like decades ago when you had to do a minimum run of whatever. You can do per order at a pretty reasonable price and hit the distribution that you used to have to get through a big publishing house.
So. And the other thing is, you know, we're at a time now where really electronic books are outselling paperbacks. Believe it or not, I still have not got a Nook or a Kindle or anything like that.
I like holding it.
I know. And maybe I'm probably going to do it one of these days. But the vast majority of my sales now are ebook, which, you know, fine by me. So long as people are, I don't care if they're reading it on a Kindle. I don't care if they're reading the paperback. So long as they're reading my stuff, that's all that matters. And so I'm like, you know, what does it matter if I go with a publishing outfit from Tasmania? Most people are going to download the book anyway, and they can download it from anywhere in the world. And so far things have been going pretty well. I've gotten some pretty good reviews since Severed Press has re-released Sea Raptor, and like I said, sales have been going fairly well, and I'm getting constant 4- and 5-star reviews on the book.
And I looked at that on Amazon. You got a pretty healthy amount of reviews, and they are all across the board. The ones that I saw on Amazon were all very good reviews, specifically hitting the character development, which is always in my reading. That's where that's what will kill a book. Is no matter how much action, no matter how much backstory, if that character development and that dialogue isn't there, I'm lost. It's not my cup of tea. So I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Let's flash forward a little bit. The Sea Raptor mega summer blockbuster hits coming out. Who do you cast?
Oh man, who do
now,
I?
Now there's a love interest in here too. That's another thing I wanted to bring up. Who is she? Who is she?
Karen Thatcher.
Karen Thatcher, not only skilled photographer, but beautiful to me. And where'd you get your technical knowledge on photography? I didn't. My phone didn't ring. Nobody asked me what kind of lenses will be used.
I don't know.
How did you write for a female voice? Do you find that harder?
You know what? Sometimes it is. Because again, in a lot of aspects, men and women can act differently. Some people are going to say, "Oh, that's sexist to say," but no, I don't find it sexist at all. And you know what? I don't find it a bad thing either. I think it's great that all kinds of people act and think differently. I think it adds a great variety to life.
My favorite genre of fiction is crime. Elmore Leonard is one of my favorite authors of all time. I've read some and I've had some suggested to me by coworkers and friends. And again, this is going to come off as sounding sexist, but I read in a guy's voice. That's what, I'm a guy. I have read some female authors that, as far as I'm concerned, a good author, you won't be able to tell, male or female. I don't know until I look at that picture on the back dust jacket. But some of them have been so skewed on how the male character's dialogue is. It's like, I don't know anybody that talks like that. And you just, it loses me. The story could be great. The main character could be great. The auxiliary characters, the background, supporting cast are so awkward that and the same thing goes for male writers. They've got female characters that are not genuine, and it really throws me when I'm reading. And then there's others that, like I said, I don't know if it's a male or female author until I flip that dust jacket over and look at it. So, back to my original question: Who you casting for the for the multi-million-dollar summer blockbuster?
That'd be a good question.
Or are you playing?
I don't think I can do Jack Raston, man. That is a really good question. God, at this point,
Who comes to mind? Is this a Tom Cruise vehicle?
No.
Matt Damon?
I did see The Martian a few weeks ago. Maybe Matt Damon could pull it off.
God, he had that
actually. And you know who I think could be really good for the part of Karen Thatcher? She'd have to dye her hair brown, but Gal Gadot. Is the one, she was in some of the Fast and Furious movies, and she's the actress who they cast to play Wonder Woman in Batman versus Superman.
So I think
Gal Gadot could be a very good Karen Thatcher.
I don't remember what she looks like, but I definitely remember and the outfit that I saw online. But,
what's funny is a lot of people got on her because she didn't have like the statuesque build for Wonder Woman, but I'm sorry, when I saw the trailer and saw her in the Wonder Woman outfit, I went, yeah, that's Wonder Woman. But, you know, I think her...
Not Linda Carter. See, Linda Carter will always be Wonder Woman in my mind.
But I think because Karen is a cross-country runner, and actually a marathon runner, so to me...
Everything flips back to sports with you.
I know. I can't help it. Even Jack Raston, when he was in high school, ran cross-country, but that was more to build up his endurance for getting ready to be in the Ranger. But, like, getting back to about writing for female characters, you know, again, sometimes it can be difficult. But, I think, like, over the years when, you know, I've read, like, you know, some books by Janet Evanovich, plus it helps that you have some female, some women in the critique groups that I go to. And, you know, it's just like, you know, treating them like just any other character, any other person. It's like, what are going to be their strengths? What are going to be their weaknesses? How are they going to respond to certain situations? And I know after a few rewrites, After my first few rewrites, I felt that Karen wasn't as strong as I'd like her to be. Because for this kind of book, you don't want to do the damsel in distress. That character is just passé right now. And quite frankly, I find it uninteresting. You want someone in there who's going to be active.
Story runner.
And I think also, given Jack's personality, that is who he's going to be attracted to. Jack is not the kind of person who's going to be attracted to, like, a doormat kind of person. He wants someone who's strong, someone who's competent, and that's what Karen Thatcher comes off as. And again, I think when you're writing for action adventure and everything, sometimes it's a little easier to write those. It's basically like the Fast and Furious movies, where it's like, you know, and you'll hear or like the Honest Trailer I saw in that, where they go interchangeable tough chicks. And it's like, that's a lot of times that's what you can write in these kind of, action adventure movies. And yeah, I mean, and actually what's funny is Karen isn't the kind of person who's going to pick up a gun and start shooting. And in fact, she's kind of shies away from guns, but she does other things
and furthers
the story that actually helps Jack Raston out.
When you were writing Karen, did you have somebody in mind or a compilation of people in mind, or was it strictly out of your own imagination?
I think it was a compilation of people I've run into during my life and also just some things out of my imagination. You know, I was like, what I want this character's background to be. How will she react in certain situations? Like I said, I have her as a marathon runner, so you got to figure she's got to be pretty disciplined. She knows how to push through when she's feeling tired, when situations aren't going her way. She's also a single mother. I don't even have a kid, so I can't imagine what that's like. But I imagine for people who are single mothers, they have a difficult job of balancing, you know, career, life, and raising their kid the best they can.
I have a son, 6 years old, and my wife often feels like a single mother. Okay, you mentioned offhandedly there Wonder Woman and Batman, Superman. Talk to me about this blog that we saw, johnjruss.wordpress.com. Mm. The top 10 most shocking moments in the DC animated universe.
This was
run through a few. Why'd you start doing this?
I don't care. I'm in my 40s. I'm still a big fan of, you know, animated, what I call animated series. You know, not cartoons or animated series now. But, you know, I'm just a big superhero nut. When the Batman versus Superman trailer came out, I was just like, I was floored by it, and I can't even tell you how many times I have watched that trailer over the past, like, 4 months. That and the Suicide Squad trailer. Like I said, I've just always been a fan of superhero stories, and you know, I watched the Batman, the animated series. I watched the Justice League animated series, which, quite frankly, I thought the first several seasons of it were just brilliant storytelling. They had great character development. They gave a lot of depth to the characters. It was nothing like, you know, the old Super Friends cartoons that, you know, you and I grew up with.
Missed the whole superhero. As a kid, mm-hmm. I was watching the reruns of the 66, you know, Burt Ward, Adam West.
Yeah.
But I was never caught up that mm-hmm. much in comic books or super. I don't know why. It went right over. I don't know.
And I always was. And just like out of the blue, one day I'm kind of thinking, you know, I was like, I think I will. all the shows I watch, and boy, there's the DC, DC animated series and movies. They pulled off some pretty big shockers. It's like, hey, what if I do a blog that just, the top 10? Yeah, just for basically, it was just one of those projects just for the fun of it.
And you even tied in Shakespeare, Star Wars, and some others into your list here,
yeah.
As far as backstory and detail here.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, like I said, it went over my head. I'm lost in this, but I am going to spend some more time to read through it. A mutual acquaintance, a good friend of mine, Matt Hinshaw, knows this stuff inside and out. So he throws out characters and quotes stuff, and I know. It's like, that was from the Batman thing? No, that was Spider-Man. I don't know. I am.
Yes, fanboys will do that. It's like, no, that's not where it came from.
But I'm fascinated by it. And later in life, I've started getting interested. But again, just on the surface, because I don't have that years of back knowledge or stuff. But I find it. What do you think of the new Gotham series?
I really enjoy it.
What network's that on? I forget.
It's on the Hulu network.
It's on Fox as far as
network.
I'm concerned.
It's on Fox. Fox does it, but
I'm enjoying it a lot.
And I think it's kind of nice to see, the characters before they became villains and heroes, and also just how, and not only that, but also just all the corruption that's going on in Gotham City, and how Jim Gordon, he's not commissioner right now. He's far from perfect.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I think that's another thing that I really enjoy about this, where Jim Gordon has to make some really difficult and sometimes morally questionable choices in order to, I guess, serve the greater good. And I think that makes a hero and a hero's journey so much more compelling than if he was just, the goody two shoes good guy who never does anything bad or something. First of all, to me, those kind of characters are actually kind of boring. You want some I wouldn't even call them characters with edges, just characters who are people, because, we are all human beings and we're all imperfect. We all have our flaws. Some flaws are bigger than other people's flaws, but still we are imperfect. And I think no matter how heroic, no matter how big a good guy someone is, you want to see those flaws so that way they're at least a little more relatable.
The physical and emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that I'm finding interesting in Gotham is some of the characters are immediately fleshed out, of course. Bruce Wayne, Alfred, Commissioner, Selina. Oh, was it Kyle? Is that her?
Selina Kyle, yeah.
Penguin.
Mm-hmm. I love Penguin in that series.
They're kind of hiding Joker. There's a couple of characters that popped up that you go, that's going to be. And no.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the. Jerome?
Jerome. I really thought he was Joker.
I thought it was it. Then he got axed out.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. It's 3 weeks old, but. Like I said, for somebody who doesn't have the background and doesn't have the foundation for the comic book genre in general, it's really holding my attention. I was curious how it would be for you, and I'm glad to hear that you're enjoying it.
No, I am. Like, it's kind of nice to see kind of a superhero, supervillain world without the supervillains, because right now it's like they're just bad guys or they're finding their way along that path. We haven't seen them really become, the Penguin or the Riddler or Catwoman like we know. And of course, at this point, Bruce Wayne is like, 12, 13 years old.
Like that, yeah.
So he has a long way to go before he even becomes Batman Begins.
Shift gears a little bit. Star Wars, is that in your wheelhouse?
Oh, heck yeah.
What are you thinking of the December release?
What do you know
about it so far, and what are you expecting?
I am really looking forward to it, especially after they released the newest trailer this past week.
That was the Monday Night Football one?
Yeah. And I'm obviously part of the Legion that really, really had a lot of problems with the last three Star Wars movies.
See, I didn't see – Star Wars came out, 75, 76?
76, 77.
Was it – okay, I was 10, 11 years old. I didn't see it for the first time until after I was out of high school. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't on my, you know, it just wasn't, mm-hmm. wasn't what I liked it, yeah. but it was, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And when I sit down with Hinshaw, he's ready to smack me in the head because I don't put, you know, Skywalker on a pedestal. I watch it, my wife loved it. She saw it when it first came mm-hmm. out when she was probably 8 or 9, and it's been the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. And so when those first, the three prequels came out, I was like, yeah, it's okay. It's as in my head, it's yeah. as good as the other ones because I wasn't a big fan.
Yeah.
I recently, when I say recently, maybe 3 years ago, watched the original again. Because mm-hmm. I'm thinking to myself, another good buddy of mine, James Haight, who's just, he's salivating at this one coming out with the J.J. Abrams mix into it and everything else. And I'm like, I don't, you know, it's okay. And he goes, no, you've got to watch them again. It's like, I'm not only is it, he doesn't agree with my opinion is wrong. That's just what it is. So I rewatched him a couple years ago. And I wanted to punch Mark Hamill in the head because he's just such a whiny little punk. What was it about the three prequels that just took it off the rails? Because well, I know that yeah. is the common thought amongst you yeah. people.
Well, like you said about with Mark Hamill, I think he started out as a whiny little punk, but as the movies progressed and he was training as a Jedi, we saw him start to become more mature. Where, and not only that, but to me, the big thing was the first three Star Wars movies, Star Wars, Empire, and Return of the Jedi. To me, what really made it, getting back to your thing of what, you know, why you like books, because of the characters. And to me, when you have Luke and Han and Leia and Chewie and 3PO and R2, to me, it's like these are characters, these are people who under any other circumstances would have never gotten together. But because of the threat of the Empire,
the common enemy.
Yes, they're forced to work together. And yeah, there's some bickering in there, which again makes it, you know, like to me adds a very human element in there where, you know, they are just such strong personalities where there's going to be arguing and there's going to be, no, I'm right, you're wrong and all that. But still, it's like they know that they have to work together in order to survive. And I also just found the characters very appealing, very enjoyable to watch. You know, Darth Vader is just such a yeah. great villain. I mean, he's
Vader and Solo are the ones that I okay, now yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
But if it was those two in a movie, I'd be okay.
Yeah. But with the prequels, I think what happened was, if I remember, I think the first Star Wars movie was shot on a $10 million budget. I think that's the exact number. I could be wrong about that. But, you know, it wasn't like the mega millions yeah, that we that see
it,
today.
That it grew into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think what happened was when we got to the prequels, you know, George Lucas all of a sudden had this mountain of money to make these movies. And he's like, I'm going to sink every penny I can into it. And I am going to have the kind of special effects that I wanted to have in the first three movies.
What was in my brain that didn't make it to film? Yeah.
And I think that was one of the problems. It just became more special effects than it did character development. And I think also there was also the element of, you knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
You knew that Anakin Skywalker was going to become Darth Vader. You knew the Jedi were all going to get killed. Out. Yeah, there wasn't that kind of suspense.
Tell me about Jar Jar. What was the problem with Jar Jar? Why?
He was
the most interesting character in those movies as far as I was concerned.
It was basically his style of comic relief just didn't
mesh.
It was like bad slapstick. You have Three Stooges slapstick, which I still laugh at today. And then you have Jar Jar and just, you know, the lines he had. And quite frankly, he just had a very annoying voice as well. Just everything about him was annoying. And then you talk about whiny little punk. To me, that that was what Hayden Christensen was as Anakin Skywalker. Now, I will give him this. When they did the animated series, The Clone Wars,
okay,
which, that came out before the movies, but Actually, there they actually did a great job with Anakin's character. He wasn't the whiny little punk that we saw in the movies. He did have some rough edges around him. He was a little emotional, but they kind of grounded the character a little bit where you could relate to him and you could feel sympathetic for him, knowing that, darn, this guy's going to become Darth Vader one day. But there was just so much wrong with the Star Wars movies, from the lack of character development, characters that really are compelling, that you sympathize with and care for, to just the overuse of special effects. There were a few highlights. I thought the climactic battle they had in Attack of the Clones, I thought that was pretty good. I thought the lightsaber fight between Darth Maul and Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn, I thought that was probably the highlight of the first movie, The Phantom Menace.
My favorite character was Grover.
Yoda.
Yoda. He's always Grover in my mind.
You know what?
Frank Oz is always...
And I'm going to tell you, you know what, Yoda's scenes. Yoda, I thought the scenes where Yoda was in, for the most part, were pretty good, because Yoda is such a cool character. Again, here's this, you know, like foot tall, Muppet looking thing, and he's the most powerful Jedi pretty much in the universe. And to me, I think that is so cool to have a character you don't expect to be such a big, powerful hero to be one. In fact, I kind of take that with Jack Rastin in Sea Raptor, because I think when you read a lot of action adventure books, usually the hero is well over 6 feet tall.
And Rastin's he's a small, almost like a high school wrestler kind of body.
Yeah. Yeah.
Compact, powerful.
Because you look in the novels, like say Mitch Rapp from Vince Flynn series. You look at Jack Reacher from the Lee Child novels. They're like between 6'2 and 6'5 and, you know, 210, 230. I mean, they're just big,
until Tom
muscular
Cruise gets
guys.
In the mix.
but he did get the personality for Jack Reacher down. I give him that. But I mean, these are guys, when they walk into a room, it's like they just give off that aura. They have that. It's like you do not want to mess with them. Where Jack Rastin, I mean, I have him as 5'10 and a buck 70. Now he's, you know, pretty lean and solid 170, but still 5'10, 170. Yeah. He's not someone who on site is going to intimidate you. But what happens is, and in fact, I even have a scene of it in this book where some drunken college student tries to pick a fight with him. Call, hey, you this, you're going to get you. And basically in about 3 seconds, Jack gets him in an elbow lock and threatens to break his elbow if he doesn't leave him alone. But again, I think that is an interesting aspect of Rastin as a hero, where the enemy looks at him and thinks, this guy,
yeah,
I can take this guy. But again, I mean, Rangers are some of the best trained warriors on the planet.
Yeah.
So when they go in there with that mentality, usually they wind up leaving either in an ambulance or a body bag.
Flip it back to Star Wars. Were you worried when Disney got in the mix?
A little bit.
Did that raise up the hairs on the back of your neck a little?
A little bit, but I was like, you know, after the last three movies, I don't think there's any way you can make it even worse. And, you know, when I saw the first couple of trailers, I'm like, yeah, this looks promising. And then I think what really solidified it for me was the trailer that came out this week, because you start to see, you know, what kind of story we might have. I don't think we fully 100% know the plot, but we're starting to see that it looks like, you know, these characters may have some depth, may have some dimension to them.
Luke is going to redeem himself.
Well, Abrams will help him with that, and I did like the one scene with the main villain there, where he's like, you know, I will finish what you started, and you're just kind of like, this looks like it could be pretty serious here. But like I said, after that third trailer, I think the line that Han Solo had to the two new characters, and I keep forgetting their names right now. I'll probably have it memorized when the movie hits. But when the woman goes, you know, the old stories, are they all true? And Han goes, every once. Now you're like, okay, so now we're at a point where it's like the Jedi and the Force are almost legend, but Han knows, no, this stuff is real, and I need to teach you young whippersnappers about that. So now we're like, I think some really good story elements into here, along with what I think looks like some pretty good action scenes. And again, it comes down to you got to have that blend of story, characters, and action to make a book or a movie or a television series work. And I think if any of those elements are missing, you know, basically you're going to have a Michael Bay Transformers where all it is just big robots blowing up and beating up one another, and they have like no distinct personalities, and you just sit there and I know, especially on the second Transformers movie, I was just sitting there and pointing out every single plot hole. Like my favorite plot hole in the movie is when they were at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, the one Transformer Jetfire knocks down the wall, and all of a sudden they're in the Boneyard in Tucson, and I'm sitting there going, okay, now I've actually been to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and I know for a fact that there's no desert with derelict planes behind the Air and Space Museum.
I remember that Megan Fox was in that movie, and that's where my attention span left, I think. Well, we are sitting just about 100 yards or so from where Star Wars will be playing in just a couple of months. I mentioned there's a couple of buddies of mine who are just, they're going to convince me that I am wrong. We're planning on doing a little roundtable podcast with a couple of buddies of mine. So when I nail that in, I'll reach out to you. Maybe you
Sounds
can
good.
Sit down and we'll sit right here at Gabby's Grill and sit around a table, and you guys can convince me. These guys know that. Well, actually, yeah. James, he's going to probably hit me for saying this, but he has written a outline to a spec script, and his pride and joy is he has a cease and desist letter from Lucasfilms hanging on his wall.
Well, he needs to take it and go. He needs to take that and go to fanfiction.com. That's what all us fanboys do.
I'm fairly certain he has.
I've got like about 70 stories up on fanfiction, so.
I'll reach out to you. I'd love to have you take
That'd
part in
great,
that. We
man.
Haven't nailed it down yet. We did not touch on one area. We're out of time here, but I think the area that we did not touch on is a podcast in itself, and that is in your heavy metal. And is it Swedish? What is your wheelhouse?
It's pretty much just really heavy metal. I listen to a lot of metal from Europe.
But it's obscure. What do you?
Maybe, you know, to some people it might be obscure, but bands like Nightwish, Within Temptation, Epica, Aelstorm, Sabaton, they have some big followings and some devoted followings around the world, and they're actually starting to grow in the U.S. They just haven't reached the mainstream level, and I think that's just because mainstream American music is just so obsessed with pop stars and rap and all that.
Mariah Carey is not on your CD or on your CD shelf, no?
No. not at all.
Your Kanye West isn't blaring through your MP3 player.
No, I don't want to listen to a guy who calls himself the greatest rock star in the world or whatever.
Give me a song that we're going to go out on, and I'll pull it on and play it on our outro.
Okay,
I got to write it down because I will not know. Go ahead.
Okay, let's go with let's go with Nightwish, Dark Chest of Wonders.
Night as in
night.
Day and night,
yep.
Or as in like the Black Knight?
No, night as in day and night.
Nightwish.
Dark Chest of Wonders.
Dark Chest of Wonders. Sounds spooky. My pen ain't working. I'll figure it out. I got a recording of this. Well, John, thank you very much. We'll have links to all your info there. Again, the name of the Arizona book is Arizona's All-Time Baseball Team. And Sea Raptor. We'll have links to those. Check them out on Amazon. You're getting some great reviews.
Right.
And check you out on KYCA every morning at 7. When you at?
Oh, I'm pretty much on throughout the day on our newscasts.
And then your dedicated show on Saturday mornings.
Saturday morning at 8:06.
Frequency and call.
1490 AM KYCA.
And online?
KYCA.info.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, Matt.
It.